Forgiveness is one of the marks of an authentic Christian. When we live in tune with God's plan, we freely demonstrate mercy, grace, and compassion toward others. But the real test comes not when we're mildly irritated with annoying behavior, but when we're violated by vindictive, cruel, or even abusive behavior. Isn't it natural to strike back? And at what point do we let our offenders off the hook? Well, today on Insight for Living, Chuck Swindoll tells a fascinating story about family betrayal and how the victim responded with grace and forgiveness. Chuck titled today's message, Extending Grace.
Appropriately, as we are working our way through this topical series on these troubled times in which we live, we call it Wise Counsel for Troubled Times. We've come to extending grace. And the best part about it is the one who models it does so in a way that very few will ever witness, as he has spent years and years of his life being abused and mistreated and kidnapped and forgotten, misjudged, imprisoned without a cause. And when he has a chance to face those who got him in that situation, he doesn't retaliate. He extends grace. Now, the climax of that appears at the end of the book of Genesis. I'll be reading for you from Genesis chapter 50. In my opinion, one of the grandest sections in all the Old Testament, as Joseph provides a perspective that is rarely mentioned in life. This comes on the heels of enormous mistreatment by the very men he's talking to. Genesis 50. I'll be reading for you verses 14 through 21. Genesis 50, 14. After burying Jacob, Joseph returned to Egypt with his brothers and all who had accompanied him to his father's burial. But now that their father was dead, Joseph's brothers became fearful. Now Joseph will show his anger and pay us back for all the wrong we did to him, they said. So they sent this message to Joseph. Before your father died, he instructed us to say to you, please forgive your brothers for the great wrong they did to you, for their sin in treating you so cruelly. So we, the servants of the God of your father, beg you to forgive our sin. When Joseph received the message, he broke down and wept. Then his brothers came and threw themselves down before Joseph. Look, look, we are your servants, they said. But Joseph replied, don't be afraid of me. Am I God that I can punish you? You intended to harm me, but God intended it all for good. He brought me to this position so I could save the lives of many people. No, don't be afraid. I will continue to take care of you and your children. So he assured them by speaking kindly to them.
You're listening to Insight for Living. To search the Scriptures with Chuck Swindoll, be sure to download his Searching the Scriptures studies by going to insightworld.org/studies. And now the message from Chuck called Extending Grace.
Victim. It's a word we hear all of the time, and admittedly some rush to it often and frequently, in fact, quickly. Some claim to have been victimized because their parents were fairly strict when they were younger, and they claim child abuse. which wasn't that at all. Or if they had a boss who expected them to work later into the evening to get the project done, they saw themselves as victimized by this tyrannical authority figure. I'm not talking about that kind of nonsense today. I'm talking about real-to-life, genuine victims, which some of you can understand and quickly identify with. Children mistreat other children, and that victimization is called bullying. Happens at school all the time. Children can victimize teachers or teachers their children in class. That also happens. Husbands can mistreat wives. Wives can mistreat their husbands. That's domestic abuse. Though they may not lay a hand on each other, it is verbal abuse as they curse one another and yell and scream and put one another down. And siblings can mistreat one another only to grow up and continue mistreating people around them. It grows into things like road rage and nonsensical acts of anger like that. And people are shot on freeways and tollways and back roads, victims of some aggressive, thoughtless act. Pastors can play king of the mountain and victimize their congregation with legalistic rules and demands. And some of you are here today to find healing from that, having been exposed to what I've often called toxic religion in previous years. Some are genuine victims of judicial mistreatment. They didn't commit the crime, but through a rush to judgment, they were declared guilty, put behind bars, and left there, only to find out later through something like a DNA discovery or someone who comes to the surface and admits he was the one or she was the one who committed the crime and they've been in there 20-whatever years. Victims of judicial abuse. Stories go on and on. In a previous church I served many years ago, we had a lovely middle-aged woman in our congregation who happened to be a Jewish individual who had converted to Christianity. But her childhood was extremely painful. She vividly remembered being called that little Jew girl by classmates in her school, never corrected by the teacher. And then when Christmas came and they all exchanged gifts, she received one to her surprise, neatly packaged, a nice ribbon on top, and when she opened it, it was full of wet garbage. Victim of racial abuse. A real victim. I know a pastor who connected with me some years ago to express growing disillusionment with ministry. He was serving in a small church, and there were pockets of people who had their own agenda. He took a stand on an issue that he had thought through very carefully and could support, he felt, from the scriptures. And he declared his position only to be disagreed with vehemently at the door of the church. But rather than work it out together in a room, intelligently and gently and quietly, in the middle of the night, some of them sneaked into his backyard and destroyed the children's swing set, and then slashed all four of his tires. A victim of abuse. A mother of several kids was overheard speaking angrily to them in a doctor's office. Busy kids, and it's easy to be frustrated. But this woman took it to a new level when one of her children touched a picture in the room, and she said to that child, "You touch that picture again, I'll break every finger on your hand." Parental verbal abuse. All of us have stories to tell, maybe not that dramatic, but I've said for years that everyone I know has someone to blame for something. You were doing right, but that person did you wrong. You meant well, but they took it the wrong way. You were carrying on a life that was marked by integrity and honesty, and word got out from a rumor that was a lie that hurt your character and caused you to lose your job. Peggy Noonan writes in one of her fine articles, "We've all been shot." She's right. If I were to ask all of you who have genuinely endured abuse of some kind to stand to your feet, and I'm not asking you to do that, some of you would suck in your breath in amazement. Most of the people in this room would be on their feet. I would join you. In case you happen to be among the rare number who have no memory of abuse, be careful that you don't lose your compassion for those who deserve it. It was Shakespeare who wrote, "He jests at scars who never felt a wound." Everything within us screams for justice. It isn't right. That's not right. And thoughts of revenge flood our minds, or retaliation. We're going to get even, or we're going to get back at them. And we're waiting. In the meantime, our bitterness grows. We don't realize it. But the one who wrote this wrote the truth when he said, "The one who gives himself to bitterness pours the poison for the person he hates, only to drink it himself, thinking the other person will die." You're eaten up with bitterness, which is no way to live. The grinding feelings of resentment are not resolved by acts of revenge. But listen to me, they're resolved by extending grace. May I say it again? They're resolved by extending grace. Say it however you want. In the New Testament, there's that strange analogy of pouring coals of fire on another person's head. Or in Proverbs, "A brother offended is harder to be won than a strong city, and their contentions are like the bars of a castle." All of this needs to be explained in practical, everyday terms. You don't need a theoretical or theological explanation. You need a practical explanation of what grace is, because we so seldom see it. Some of us would be hard-pressed to remember the last time we witnessed with our own eyes an act of grace from one human being toward another. How sad. So I'm deliberately staying away from long, drawn-out definitions that have stingers in their tails, as I describe to you what unmerited favor really means. Here are some examples. Doing what is best and right when you have been done wrong, that's grace. Responding with an attitude of forgiveness, even though the guilty person never repents and never asks for forgiveness. Yes, you understood correctly. Even though there isn't repentance, you forgive. That's called grace. They don't deserve it, but you extend it. You forgive. Showing kindness toward those who haven't earned it. Removing any and all thought of getting even or getting back at someone else. Where is it needed? The examples proliferate in our minds. When you've been maligned or mistreated, when you suffer even though you did what's right, when you must endure the consequences of somebody else's sin or disobedience, and you, an innocent victim, get caught in the backwash of their consequences. I think of several specific examples. The loss of a marriage that you never wanted, but your partner, quote, just doesn't love you anymore. The loss of a business because your partner chose to break the contract and stole from you. The loss of a friendship that need never have occurred. forced to accept a demotion when you really didn't deserve it, but because of the prejudice of the superior, you were demoted. Having things said about you that are neither fair nor factual. That's all description of true victimization. So understand, I'm not denying the victimizing. I'm simply offering another solution that you will rarely hear, and even more rarely witness. Perfect example in all of history would be the Lord Jesus, who never did one wrong thing or thought one wrong thing or had one wrong motive, but was crucified by people dripping with sin. And his words on the cross, "Father, forgive them. They don't even know what they're doing." What grace. An unforgettable example of someone like this is Joseph. One of my all-time favorite characters in the Bible is Joseph. Not a perfect man, certainly not, but a remarkable man. Interestingly, his story covers the last 14 chapters of this big book of Genesis, 50 chapters, and Joseph occupies it from 37 all the way to 50. In fact, when we first meet Joseph, he's a teenager. Chapter 37, verse 2, when Joseph was 17 years old. There he is. Let me show you the last time he appears in the book. Genesis 50, very end of the chapter, very end of the book, verse 26, the last verse. So Joseph died at the age of 110. 93 years he is portrayed in the Bible. Now, not every part of his life is revealed, certainly not. But some of the bigger parts of his life are set forth. It all starts because Joseph is the favored son of his daddy. Jacob has had a large family, and along comes Joseph, a child of Jacob's old age, and is often true of parents who bear children later in life. There's something special about the baby born in the closing years of your ability to reproduce. Jacob found great delight in Joseph and loved him in a special way, to the point where he showed favoritism to Joseph. The problem is Joseph has a house full of brothers who resented him for that. Because of their resentment, they decided they would take it out on him. He's out in the field working the flocks of one of his half-brothers. And while he's out there, these ornery brothers decide, we got to do something about it. And it made it worse that Joseph had a dream. Get this. He's 17, remember. You do things like this when you're 17. He dreams that he's in charge of the brothers, and one day they will bow down to him. Not a good thing to share with your brothers who already hate you. And they hated him more. That's it. One of them said, throw him in a cistern and let him die. Another one had enough presence of mind, said, whoa, 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 wait a minute. Wait, hold it. No reason to kill him. Just drop him in the cistern. And we'll leave him there. In the process of this cruel discussion, along comes a caravan of Ishmaelites, Arabs. They don't know any of them. They're on the caravan to the land of Egypt. They're coming through the land of Canaan, where Joseph and his brothers live. And the brothers go, hot dog, we'll sell him. And for 20 shekels of silver, they sell him to these Ishmaelites, who say, that's fine, we'll sell him as a slave and make more money there. So they take him to Egypt. He doesn't deserve this. He doesn't deserve to be abandoned. Or as he puts it a little later in his story, chapter 40, verse 15, he was kidnapped. He saw it as a kidnap. They kidnapped me. Now think about this. Listen to me. Remember when you were 17. It'll take some of you a little while. But remember back when you were 17. Okay? Life was pretty simple, pretty innocuous. and you've got a few brothers that don't like you, and the next thing you know, you're tied up in a caravan with a bunch of strangers, dirty, speaking a language you don't know, taking you to a place of a whole nother custom and a whole nother language, and drops you off in a slave market. And there you are to be sold to somebody. That's called being a victim. 17-year-old kid, suddenly now in Egypt, doesn't even know what people are saying as they talk about how much they would pay for Joseph. And along comes a man named Potiphar. Potiphar is a high official in the land of Egypt. He answers to Pharaoh. He's in charge of Pharaoh's army, high-ranking individual. He needs help in his home. So he buys Joseph as a slave and decides that he'll put him in charge of some things around his house. So he took Joseph and brought him in his house. And wouldn't you know it, the Lord was with Joseph. And by now, Joseph is picking up the language and certainly knows what integrity and hard work are all about. So he proves himself faithful. And little by little, well, he's in charge of the whole household. Stay with the story. Here's Joseph, learning a language, learning a custom, now in charge of a large house and everything that Potiphar has except Potiphar's wife. She comes along with the package deal. And we read in chapter 39, verse 7, Joseph is handsome, a well-built young man, or verse 6, and then chapter 39, verse 7, Potiphar's wife soon began to look at him lustfully. "Come and sleep with me," she demanded. That is not called the subtle temptation. She didn't mess around. "I want you, I like your body, come to bed with me." Joseph refused. Look, he told her. "My master trusts me with everything in his entire household. No one here has more authority than I do. He's held back nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How could I," look at this integrity, "how could I do such a wicked thing? It'll be a great sin against God. Not only would it be wrong against my master who trusts me, I would have to answer to God for that. I can't do that, lady. Leave me alone." Verse 30, she doesn't take no for an answer. Or verse 10, she kept putting pressure on Joseph day after day, and he refused to sleep with her, and he kept out of her way as much as possible. I mean, she's on the make. She's coming after him. One day, however, no one else is around, and he went in to do his work. She came and grabbed him by his cloak, demanding, "Come on, sleep with me." Joseph tore himself away, but left his cloak in her hand as he ran from the house. Good for you, Joseph. Good for you. Just say no. You'll never get in trouble if you just say no. The problem is, she doesn't like being stood up. Who does he think he is?
Though it's a familiar story, I've certainly never heard it told with this level of color and detail. You'll be glad to know that we'll be looking at the life of Joseph for the next several days as Chuck Swindoll guides us through this wonderful passage in Genesis. You're listening to Insight for Living and a message Chuck has titled Extending Grace. To learn more about this ministry, visit us online at insightworld.org. Grace has been a central theme on this program from the very beginning because it's a central theme of the Bible. And many of our listeners tell us that Insight for Living was the genesis of their personal grace awakening. Some have been listening to Chuck's teaching on grace for 10, 20, even 30 years and more. And at this stage of life, they're much more capable of giving financially than in the early days. Recently, someone left a comment that said, "Chuck, for the past 10 years, I've been listening to you on the radio as I drive to work in the morning. Your sermons, your laughter, and your genuine love for Christ radiates from your broadcast. In fact, you've taught me to laugh again. My life has been tough, as is everyone's, but you've taught me to laugh and enjoy my God-given life and share this laughter with others." And the comment was signed this way, "Smiling in His name." Well, perhaps you're ready to do for a young student or a family what someone once did for you. As a monthly companion, you agree to give a donation every month. And in this role, you'll be sending a fresh aroma of God's grace to someone who's never discovered what that truly means. To take this step right now, here's the number to call. If you're listening in the United States, call 1-800-772-8888. Or sign up online at insight.org/monthly companion. If you're listening in the U.S., our phone number once again is 1-800-772-8888. Or give online at insight.org.
My friend, more than ever, Insight for Living Ministries is determined to serve as a lavish garden for people all around the world who long to smell the aroma of God's matchless grace. A safe place where imperfect, sinful people are forgiven, taught the truth, and redeemed.
There's a simple and effective way to leverage your support of Chuck Swindoll's ministry. Become a monthly companion.
In this emotionally charged era where shouting matches are commonplace, where people feel voiceless and overlooked and even condemned, would you be among those who give generously so that we can spread the fragrance of God's grace to those desperate for a second chance?
Become a monthly companion today. If you're listening in the United States, call 1-800-772-8888 or go to insight.org/monthly companion.
Together, let's introduce people to the God who says, "My grace is all you need. My power works best in weakness."
Again, if you're listening in the United States, call 1-800-772-8888 or go to insight.org/monthly companion. Join us again Friday when Chuck Swindoll continues his message on extending grace, right here on Insight for Living.
The preceding message, Extending Grace, was copyrighted in 2013, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2017 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide. Duplication of copyrighted material for commercial use is strictly prohibited.